So I'm a professor at the Collège de France and a colleague now for some years, has been working for many, many years on trying to understand how cell decisions and plasticity happen in the brain. And in particular, after his seminal discoveries on how some transcription factors that we all classically thought were working happily in their own nucleus can actually function between cells, not just within cells. He has explored in many different contexts how indeed the brain is a far more plastic organ than we ever believed. And his studies, most recent studies, I guess he will be telling us about OTX2, and how in different periods of development, there are windows where decisions are made, and how one can actually extrapolate from all that to understand in pathological situations whether one actually can reverse the effects, for example, in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So today, he will be telling us about some of his most recent work, and there's always something new when you talk to Alain. So I'm really excited to hear about what you're going to tell us. Merci, Alain.
Thank you, Edith. I mean, it's very nice to be here. I mean, I see faces that I had not seen for a while. I mean, and it's a great pleasure, I must say. So, as Edith mentioned, I mean, my lab has discovered a new function for this class of transcription factors that we call homeoprotein transcription factors. And this new function is signaling. I mean, between cells, as these transcription factors can travel between cells. I will not go into the mechanisms of secretion and internalization, which are very specific to this process. I would just like to mention that recent studies have shown that this is a very general property of many of these transcription factors. I mean, the work by a group of Jin-Woo Kim has shown that 160 of these homeoproteins can transfer between cells, which in a way make these proteins, I mean, the most, I would say, at least quantitatively, I mean, the biggest family of signaling molecules in the vertebrates, in plants as well, in fact. Indeed, I mean, this raises the issue of whether these transcription factors are morphogenes, I mean, in the sense that was coined to the term by Alan Turing in 1951, and we have been exploring that, other groups as well, and you have here some examples of how, I mean, these transcription factors can be used as morphogenes, I mean, in the developing body, but also, I mean, has these transcription factors have adult physiological functions that I will allude to, I mean, later. In fact, this is not absolutely new because, as many of you know, Bicoid, which is a homeoprotein, was one of the first morphogenes identified in the fly. And this was no surprise at the time because this is at the syncytial stage of the fly development. So, I mean, there is no problem for Bicoid to diffuse along the anterior-posterior axis. In fact, does not diffuse that much. I mean, the messenger RNA is transported, and there is some local translation of the transcription factor. But still, you have the graded expression. Oh, excuse me. You have the graded expression of the transcription factor, and this allows. I mean, the with the thresholds, you have domains in which you have specific targets activated, like the OTD RNA, or the Hunchback RNA, or the crippled RNA. And this is according to the very well-known French flag, I mean, problem that was first proposed by Louis Volpert, and indicating, I mean, suggesting that with thresholds, a uniform gradient can create distinct compartments in the morphogenetic field. Now, a recent paper, or a recent 2017 paper by the group of Eric Vichaus, was very exciting in this context because he could show, I mean, with his colleagues, that in fact, when you have an expression of gene which is not sensitive to the concentration of decoid, I mean, you don't need to have the remodeling of your chromatin. But if, when you have expression which is concentration sensitive, then decoid has to modify the structure of the chromatin. I don't know why. I mean, has to modify the structure of the chromatin to bind its own enhancers. So you have first an activity at the chromatin level, a modification of the structure of the chromatin, and this first activity allows the same transcription factors to occupy its enhancers. And this, I think, is a very interesting concept, which I will come back later in the context of our own work. Our own work is on what we call critical periods of development. Now, I'm going now from fly to brain, and as you know, I mean, as you might know, in fact, I mean, plasticity, high plasticity in the cortex is a very transitory period. I mean, in fact, at the beginning of your postnatal life, you're not extremely plastic, and then you have this critical periods of plasticity, which allow you to adapt to the environment. And you learn vision, you learn how to talk, you learn how to calculate, and you also learn social skills. And this is with time. And it's a very important period because this is a period during which, I mean, your brain has to adapt to the environment. And it can do it only during these periods. I mean, very, very difficult to adapt later in life. Although, as you will see, it is possible. Now, a very classical case of the adaptation is the binocular vision, which has a concept which was developed by Hubbel and Wiesel in the 1960s. Now, in a binocular animal, I mean, the two eyes will project through a thalamic relay to the cortex and will be equally represented in the cortex. Now, if you close one eye during the critical period of plasticity, what happens is that the remaining eye invades at the level of the terminals, invade the regions that should be occupied by the blue eye, so to say, which has been closed. So you have a sort of adaptation to the environment. You become monocular, basically. Indeed, I mean, if you reopen the eye during the critical period of plasticity, you can go back to the normal state. But if you reopen the eye after plasticity has closed, you will remain with a lazy eye. You will keep a lazy eye. I mean, you will be, you have amblyopia for the rest of your life. And this is true for vision, but not only for vision, as I said. It's true also for many other characteristics of the human body, of the body, animal body. I mean, motor, language, and higher cognition processes. I will come back to that. For the binocular plasticity in the visual cortex of the mouse, this takes place between P20 and P40. So during 20 years, you are highly plastic. Now, this plasticity period corresponds to the maturation of the inhibitory GABAergic neurons called large basket parvalbumin cells that synapse on the excitatory neurons called principal cells, which are pyramidal cells. Now, before the opening of the critical period, the EI balance is in favor of excitation. And then you have a slow maturation of your GABAergic neurons, and you shift the EI balance to where an increase in inhibition, which is consolidated in the adult non-plastic stage. So this is very important. The maturation of this class of cells is what triggers plasticity in the developing cerebral cortex. Now, this is, yeah, I'm sorry. So this, as I said, happens for all cells. This is what happens here. And at the end of the process, you have a huge interaction between the GABAergic and glutamatergic, and you have oscillations taking place due to the kinetics of deactivation of some receptors. I don't go into the details. But the gamma high-frequency oscillations are very indicative of the mature nervous system and of a good cognitive system in the brain, which is something important. Now, this increase in inhibition, I mean, is due to the arrival into this parvalbumin neuron, which are surrounded to the assembly. I mean, these are the PV cells. I mean, when you open the eyes, then an extracellular matrix called the perineuronal net is assembled around these cells. You can see it in green because it's labeled by WFA lectin. And this allows something very important, which is the internalization of a TX2, the transcription factor, by the PV cells, because the TX2 has a sequence here, which allows for the binding to the PNNs through the binding recognition of specific glucose aminoglycans. And following this binding, the protein is internalized here in red into the PV cells and initiates its maturation. Okay? So you need to assemble these guys, then you can have a TX2 internalized, and this internalization will start the differentiation of your cells and will start the critical period of plasticity. If you block OTX2 internalization, and this can be done, we have a mouse here, in which we have introduced a gene which encodes for a single chain antibody against OTX2. So you can induce the secretion of the antibody when the PV cells start to mature early in development, and the antibody is secreted by the PV cells, specifically OTX2 mouse. So in these mice, if PV is expressed, OTX2 antibodies are secreted. OTX2 is trapped outside, doesn't get in, and you can see here that this blocks the maturation of your PV cells. You can see here OTX2 in the wild type, PVQE, in a mouse in which you have expressed a single chain antibody against PAC6, which is a control, and here you see that you lose OTX2 internalization. And if you do that, you retard the expression of plasticity genes. You see in black here that in this mice, you have a lesser expression of plasticity genes, and you don't have plasticity in these animals. So this is the direct demonstration, genetic demonstration, that the UTX2 transfer between the choroid plexus and the PV cells is necessary for the opening of critical period. I'm just going to show you a few tools that we need. One tool is the injection in the CSF of cell powerful Cre, which is a Cre TAT, and of an AAV5 virus, which encodes OTX2. Now, if you do that, if you use the antibody, if you use the AAV5 encoding OTX2, you have a specific expression of OTX2 in the choroid plexus. This is important to our gain of function experiments. And if you use the Cre TAT peptide, it is also internalized specifically by the choroid plexus, and then you can activate the secretion of the TX2 by the choroid plexus and its accumulation in the CSF. So this is just a tool slide that you might need to understand the rest of the talk. So if we take now an adult animal, and this is pretty amazing, but you take now an adult animal, plasticity has been closed. Is past the critical period. And now what you will do is to express the antibody, force the choroid plexus to secrete the OTX2 antibody, and then block OTX2 import into the PV cells, because OTX2 is imported into the PV cells throughout life. Now, if you do that, as I show here, you lose OTX2 in your PV cells, you decrease OTX2 in your PV cells, and what happens? But you reactivate plasticity. This is reactivation of the plasticity genes, as you can see here. And this was an amblyopic mouse in which we have blocked OTX2 transfer and has retrieved binocular vision. So you can repair the amblyopic phenotype in the adult mouse by blocking OTX2 internalization by the PV cells. And this means that plasticity is the default state of the brain. You need to block plasticity by OTX2 import. And if you just release the OTX2 import, then you reopen plasticity in the adult. this is what I showed. In fact, you were amblyopic, and you are not amblyopic anymore. So this is exactly a sort of summary. I opened my eyes, I mean the mouse does, at P14. OTX2 starts to be accumulated. At the first threshold, I have the opening of plasticity. At the second threshold, I have a closure of plasticity. But if I remove OTX2 in the adult, I can induce adult plasticity. Okay. So what are the genes which might be responsible for that? I mean, we have mice. I don't want to go into the details, but we have mice that open plasticity at P20 and are highly plastic at P30, which are non-plastic at P30, other mice, non-plastic at P30, mice which are non-plastic at P100, and mice which are plastic at P100 due to modifications in the OTX2 gene, which I'm not going to describe now. So when you do that, you can identify some genes which are only expressed in the PD layer during plasticity. And these are the genes which are expressed during plasticity, and you can recognize guys like ARK, GR2, FOS, NEUR1, etc. Now, the nice thing about the fact that OTX2 is internalized by the cells is that it doesn't need to be translated inside the cells. So you can add cyclohexamide to your cortex, to infuse cyclohexamide inside your cortex, and then you have only the direct targets of OTX2. And when you do that, you find that the only direct target of OTX2 is GAD45. And in fact, during the critical period, you have an increase in GAD45 expression and a decrease of GAD45 expression later in life, which led us to see whether this GAD45 expression could be modified in the adult by blocking OTX2 arrival. Now, if you block OTX2's arrival into the PV cells by expressing the antibody at the level of the choroid plexus, indeed, you have an increase of GAD45 expression in the PV cells, and specifically in this structure. This is a pre-mRNA, so you don't see the nuclear accumulation. And you see that GAD45 is upregulated by the expression of the SCSV-OTX2 antibody, but not by the expression of the PAX6 antibody. If you now express GAD45 in adult PV cells, you take a virus and you force the expression of GAD45 in the adult PV cells, what you see is that you have an increase in the plasticity gene expression, and you have an increase, in fact, in plasticity. How does that happen? We don't know, but we speculate that, in fact, GAD45 might modify the methylation status of some enhancers or promoters. And in fact, by bisulfate sequencing, we've shown that for FOS. But this is pretty, I would say, preliminary. And we are now, I mean, doing more experiments that will describe, well, I will not describe them totally. But what I would like to show you is that if you look at your PV cells, which are surrounded by this matrix, which is decorated by this lectin, and you look at the, I would say, the pattern of MeCP2 staining, you can see, in fact, that in P30 mice during plasticity, you have this type of pattern with a huge number of small, I would say, foci, and this decreases with time. In the adult, I mean, you have less MeCP2 foci. This is only happening in the PV cells, not in the surrounding cells. This is also, now if you decrease OTX2 in the adult by forcing the SCSV expression, you have an increase in the number of MeCP2 foci. And if you force GAD45 expression in the same PV cells, you also now return to an embryonic, I mean, to late to a plastic phenotype for the MeCP2, I mean, staining. And this is also true for H3K9 methyl-3 staining, where you have a decrease in number of foci. If you express the antibody, you have a re-increase in the number of foci, and this is something which is transitory, P7, P20, P30, and then you go down, but you can re-increase. I mean, also for DNA strand breaks, I'm sorry, for DNA strand breaks, you have the same type of thing. So something happens to your chromatin during the critical period, and something happens to your chromatin during plasticity, even reinduced plasticity in the adult. Okay. So I go back to this Bicoid story because what may happen is that before opening of plasticity, you may have some type of chromatin structure. Now, during the critical period plasticity, you can modify your chromatin structure. Maybe OTX2 participates in that, allowing OTX2 to gain access to its own enhancers, just like I said for Bicoid at the beginning. And then in the adult, you have a third state. Now, when you reopen plasticity, it's a nice question to know whether do you go back to this state or do you have another state of your chromatin? Because this is a way to ask the question of adult versus developmental plasticity, which is not necessarily the same thing. And also the same type of, you know, a question was raised for regeneration versus development. It doesn't have to be exactly the same thing. And the differences might be interesting to study. So we're going to go further into these studies using the PVQE NewTRAP mice and all these fancy technologies, which are extremely complicated, especially for someone like me who has been working his entire life on a simple organ. I mean, the brain, I mean, you know, very simple organ. And I'm not kidding. The brain is a very simple organ, you know. This is a brain. This is the cortex. And you see here this region is one cortex. I mean, this region is another piece of the cortex that have distinct functions. But you wouldn't be able to make the difference in terms of cell types. It's always the same pattern, okay? So in fact, I mean, the different parts of the cortex are defined by what gets in and what gets out. Be it vision or being mood, I mean, the problem is what gets in and what gets out. But the computing at the level of the cortex is always the same. It always involves, I mean, across the six layers, the same cell types and the same circuitry and the same mechanisms. So that if you understand amblyopia, you might be understanding mood disorders, okay? And this is what we're doing in the lab, I mean, and I will show you the last results that we got before we go for lunch. And this is true throughout the cortex, throughout the 52 bone mine areas. Okay. Now, we showed before that OTX2 is not only internalized in the visual cortex. OTX2 is internalized throughout the brain in all the PV cells, auditory cortex, amygdala, somatosensory cortex, medial prefrontal cortex. You find OTX2 transferred from the choroid plexus. So that the plasticity of these regions might respond to the same mechanism than the plasticity of the visual cortex. And this is very important. It's very important because, you know, there is a very important critical period during development, which is during adolescence. You can see here that you have the EI inhibition increases and excitation decreases, and the EI balance is shifted around 15 years of age in the developing human. And a lot of people now in clinicians believe that several psychiatric diseases might be diseases of the critical period. In fact, I mean, in the adult, you have this high gamma band power, which is due to the maturation of the inhibition in the medial prefrontal cortex. But during adolescence, as you can see here, this is the early childhood, this is the gamma powers, and this is now the late adolescence, and this is the early adolescence. And at late adolescence, you have a decrease in the gamma bands. And then you recover when you become adult. And this means that there is a period of development in the medial, in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, where you have a sort of disorganization of your networks that might correspond to a critical period of plasticity necessary to adapt to the adult world, to the new social world that, you know, goes with the arrival of hormones. Now, just one mouse, which I want to show you. This mouse is the OTX2 plus AA mouse. as I told you, we have a sequence here that allows the TX2 to recognize the pyrenonal nets and allows its internalization. So you can mutate this arcane to alanine, and you decrease the specificity of the recognition between the PV cells and the TX2. For that reason, you dilute a TX2 because it goes into other cell types. And this, because you always have the same amount of a TX2 made by your choroid plexus, what happens is that you reach plasticity later. I mean, you know, you increase in PV cells the level of TX2 slower, so you reach the first threshold later, and you reach the second threshold later. And as you can see here, plasticity in the visual system now takes place at P100 when it took place at P30 in the wild-type animal. And this, again, is a demonstration that you have a direct non-cell autonomous activity of a TX2 between the choroid plexus and the PV cells. I show this slide because I will need it in my last. So we're not going to work on schizophrenia in the mouse. I don't think it would be very sensible. But we are going to try to see whether amblyopia can be a model for mood disorders that take place in the human. And we look at anxiety. So to study anxiety, there are several tools. I'll show you just one tool, which is the open, the elevated plus maze. You put the mouse here, and a normal mouse, like you and me, would go undercover, okay? It would be scared. And a mouse which is not anxious will start traveling in the open arms, okay? I mean, make many entries and travel a lot in these arms. And you can see here that in the OTX2 heterozygote mouse, which is slow in developing its plasticity, you have an increase in the time spent in the open arm, an increase in the number of entries into the open arms, and no change in locomotion. And this shows you that this mouse is hypo-anxious. Okay? There is no difference between males and females, and this is a phenotype that takes place very early. I mean, at 1 month, you already can see it. Okay? And it maintains, it is maintained at least until 4 months. We didn't look later. If you use the OTX2 AA mouse, which is a plus AA mouse, in which OTX2 arrives more slowly into the PV cells, what you see, in fact, is that you also have a decreased anxiety. So these mice are hypo-anxious. Now, as I said, you can force the expression of OTX2 in your choroid plexus in the adult. So now take this adult mice, and now you're going to force OTX2 expression in the choroid plexus of these mice. What happens? That in fact, you are going to increase anxiety. You're going to fix the hypo-anxious phenotype in the adult mouse by manipulating OTX2 in the choroid plexus. Conversely, you can take a normal mouse, you can block OTX2 in the choroid plexus, its secretion is transported into the PV cells, and now you're going to make your mice less anxious. Okay? So this is very important because it means that you can take an adult animal and modify its level of anxiety by a very simple manipulation, which is to modify OTX2 level in the choroid plexus. And this led us to this model, which we call the MUDI project. In this MUDI project, we propose that what happens at the level of the retina, the treatment of the information at the level of the PV cells, and the influence of the choroid plexus, which provides OTX2 to the PV cells in the adult, also takes place in a more complicated system, like which is the mood disorders, I would say, where you have a signal. And we have proposed that the eye in the brain for mood disorders would be the ventral tegmental area. Okay. And in a way, I mean, it's pretty exciting because it would suggest that anything which is done to cure amblyopia, for example, might be thought of by people who would like to cure psychiatric disorders and mood disorders. Now, can I have 2 more minutes? Okay. So why VTA? Why the VTA? The VTA is a structure which is in the midbrain. It's a structure that makes dopamine, and the structure which is very interesting, and you will see why. Now, when we published this first paper, I mean, Takao Hench at the time, the reviewers wanted us to show that OTX2 could be transported from the eye to the brain. So we injected the TX2 in the eye with the biotin, and we could indeed find OTX2 in the PV cells with the collabing between the biotin and PV, as you can see here. So it was proposed, even though it was never demonstrated, that something happens here when you open your eyes, and then that OTX2 could travel to the PV cells, force the assembly of the PNNs, and then allowing for OTX2 to be internalized by the choroid plexus. In fact, what is interesting is that OTX2 doesn't have to be transported, because if you block OTX2 at the level of the eye, if you decrease OTX2 at the level of the eye, by blocking the transfer of OTX2 between the bipolar cells to the ganglion cells, I don't go into the details, it's enough to block the opening of plasticity in the visual cortex. And this is why, I mean, we are interested in the VTA, because VTA is a huge structure for OTX2 expression in the midbrain, okay? And these cells are dopaminergic neurons, which are very much involved in the regulation of mood. Now, an interesting point is that the VTA projects on most of the structures which regulate mood and cognition in the mouse. And if you overexpress a TX2 in a neuron within the VTA, you will see that it can travel into the axons. So there is a sort of parallel between what we would expect here and that what is happening here. And this is why I think that the MoodEye project is very exciting. At least it excites me and a few people in the lab, which I think is the only important point. So about these few people in the lab, okay? This has been the collaboration, a long, long, I would say, standing collaboration with the group of Takao Hench at Harvard University. He's also a professor at Tokyo University now. And Sugiyama, I mean, has been really, I mean, Sayaka Sugiyama has been really a very beautiful and important colleague at the time. We also had some collaborations with other people. In the lab, I mean, now Ariel is co-heading the lab. So Ariel is playing a very important function in the lab. Indeed, he's a new king, I would say, right? And he's working with David, Rachel, Jérôme, and I would like to acknowledge Michel Volovich, because Michel Volovich has been very important to develop many of the tools that I have presented today. These are all the people that have participated in the work: Javier, Marine, Clémence, Clémentine, Jessica, Namsuk, Damien, and Julien. They have left now. And Rachel and David are still working in the lab. They are students, for Ariel students. Jérôme has been doing some physiology. I mean, he's not in my group, but he has done some physiology. And there is also a guy whom I could not identify, but seems to be still sticking around in the lab. And the people who have been helping us with the money, I mean, CNRS, Collège de France in Somme, Brainever, which is the company that I have started, and which is, now part of the LabCom between, with CNRS, Collège de France and in Somme, the CIRB indeed, and all the classical agencies. And thank you very much.